Hi, you're listening to Streaming Justice, a youth-led discussion on civil rights, past, present, and future, in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. This is Ada Griffin. I'm 16 years old, and I'm a junior at Pittsburgh Kappa.
Hi, this is Zaina Badisa. I'm 16 years old, and I am also a junior at Pittsburgh Kappa.
Hi, this is Susan Richardson. I'm 16 years old in 10th grade at Propel Braddock Hills.
If you'd like to join in on the conversation, we'd love to have your participation. You can call or text us at 412-200-5973 or tweet questions to Pittsburgh Youth Express. All right, so we'd like to start off with a quote by Dr. Martin Luther King. This is from his Beyond Vietnam speech, which was one of the last speeches he gave. And in this quote, he's talking about black soldiers who were sent off to fight. "We were taking the black young men who had been crippled by our society and sending them 8,000 miles away to guarantee liberties in Southeast Asia, which they had not found in Southwest Georgia and East Harlem. So we've been repeatedly faced with the cruel irony of watching Negro and white boys on TV screens as they kill and die together for a nation that has been unable to seat them together in the same schools."
So furthermore, we'd like to talk about the oppression systems in school and the education breakdown. Like, for example, 54% of students in the district are black and take AP classes as of 2014, while only 8% of students from that class graduated, and 77% of Caucasian students graduated and took the exam.
Yeah, in general, across the country, there is a disparity in suspension rates between black students and white students, and particularly black girls. Despite being the minority of most students, they are suspended at a higher rate than any other group. And this is according to a Penn State study. Schools that have more black students and minority students have much higher rates of expulsions and suspensions than predominantly white schools. This is just part of identifying the problem about a larger education issue, where black students are being taken out of classes and removed from school, and generally not getting the quality of education that we deserve. So this can be seen in many different ways. At our public school system in Pittsburgh, we have to choose between taking AP classes and taking African American literature or African American history, which are always PSP, and that is a problem for students who want to go to college and want to get good grades, but also want to learn about our own history, and we can't. We don't have that option at a high level.
The option shouldn't be whether or not what to take an AP or CAS class. It should be based on what the students want and what they feel they can achieve within their own systems of oppression.
Yeah, and this is we go to Kappa, so we're very lucky to even have African American history as an option for us, or African American literature. But at other schools, sometimes that's not even available, and that's definitely a problem. And then also with this, it goes into the school-to-prison pipeline, which is a term that's used to refer to the way that students of color often do poorly in schools, and that leads to them doing poorly later in life and eventually ending up in the juvenile justice system. Part of this is due to the fact that, again, they're suspended and expelled and disciplined at a higher rate than other students, but also because the crimes that they're punished for are often subjective, so the teacher gets to decide for themselves exactly what they are. For example, black girls are more likely to be punished for things like talking loudly, where white people would be punished for things like skipping class. So there's a very clear boundary, and then the other option, it's up to what the teacher thinks. So that's part of the reason that there's a problem.
How are things at your school, Susan, in Braddock Hills?
There's not really many there's a lot of fighting that goes on. We have more of a student of color ratio than we do have white minority. So there's not many of, there's more problems, and they don't really tell us how things go, how if we do poorly, you could get sent to certain places if you don't do, they don't tell you what could happen after school. They give you an idea, they give you a taste, but they don't exactly explain. So many kids have no idea what they're doing, if they're throwing their life away or not.
Do the teachers or counselors kind of tell you the ratio of students, or really do they explain to you about the differences between AP classes and the CAS classes, or what kind of courses do you guys offer?
I don't know if I'm in a high enough grade to know these different classes. I know that we have history classes. We have mainly classes like that. We don't have specific classes on specific things. We have current world lenses. We have an English class. We have a war class, but they're spanning on certain grades.
And we also want to talk about how this attitude about Black kids being more dangerous, about being more likely to break the rules, is harmful to us, not just in schools, but also just out in the world, when kids that are 12 years old can be shot for just holding a toy gun. It's just an example of how we're dehumanized almost. And young kids are described as adults on police scanners all the time. And Black kids are just in general always viewed as a threat. And partially that comes from being viewed as a threat in schools.
So Ada, in your experience, what would you say, how would you rate our education system, as in getting kids the information about what classes they should be taking and whether or not it pertains to being like of race, or like how would you judge the ratio of how many kids are of color or how many kids are not?
Yeah, I take a lot of AP and CAS classes, and I can say the vast majority of the time I'm one of maybe two or three people of color in the classroom. I mean, it's gotten a little bit better over the past few years, but in general, it's not really fun to be the only kid in the classroom that kind of like feels the way that you do. And there's all kind of issues that come up with that. But in a broader sense, I think that I take one PSP class this year. I decided to take African American History, which is not an advanced class, but that class is majority Black, and most PSP classes have a greater ratio of students of color than CAS and AP classes, and that just goes to show how, or just kind of raises questions about why that is. So why would there be more white kids in the gifted and talented program or in the AP class programs when they're not necessarily smarter than Black kids or kids of color? Like, that just doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
That's definitely understandable. I'm like in the same position as you, and I did decide to take a PSP physics class this year, and I'm noticing that I'm meeting a lot more students that just so happen to be African American that I never really had any classes with before, and I'm becoming more of friends with them. And I didn't really realize that until now, that I was one of the few kids in advanced classes. And so I guess that relates back to getting kids the education that they need, and No Child Left Behind. No Child Left Behind has to do with making sure that every single kid in the district gets the education that they need and the fair chances to get to where they need to be, whether it be college in the future or somewhere else, or a trade school, or whatever they want to go into doing in their career or future. Ada, how would you feel, how do you feel being one of the only African-American kids?
Just in general, it can be a bit alienating being the only student of color in a classroom, especially when students just are not very knowledgeable. Like, a lot of white students will make statements that they think are fine and not at all problematic, but they can really be hurtful. And you don't really want to say anything, because then you're like that one crazy Black girl in the classroom who everybody's always, you know, sighing when they say anything. Like, my teacher in English, she won't even, like, call on me in class because she knows that I'll be saying something like, hey, this article is really not great. It's kind of racist. And, you know, you get that trope as, like, the angry Black girl the time.
Yeah, or sometimes it's only acceptable. Like, I'm in a writing class. I take my major in literary arts. And so currently I'm in fiction, and we had to make these chapbooks, and we had to pick a theme for these chapbooks. And so I picked race and identity. And most of my classmates, whether they say it slightly and they insinuate it, they kind of said that, oh, yeah, that's good for you. Like, you're kind of the only person who can touch on that, being African-American and not being had anything said against you.
One thing that a girl said to me recently in my classroom, she was a white girl, and on that day I happened to be the only person of color in the room. And she was just talking general, and she was like, well, the Black girls, they kind of scare me at this school. Like, they're always so rowdy and loud. And I was just like, why would you, what makes you think that? Like, why would you have that attitude at such a young age that makes you think that these Black girls are, like, in some way a threat to you? And she was like, well, they just, you know, they're always dancing and singing. And, like, just
that's
kids
just
being kids is considered a threat for some reason. Like, dancing in the hallway, not hurting anybody, not threatening anybody, not even yelling at anybody or being rude, even though, like, as women of color, we have the most to be angry about. Like,
so basically, they're offended by culture and stance and just like creativity, which is sort of wrong.
It's especially like, at an art school. Like, this girl herself is a singer, and she was just saying, like, they're always singing and being noisy. And I was like, well, I don't know what you expect. Like, they're all vocal majors. The girls that she was talking about were. And then she continued to say that she felt like there was some separation in the public school system here in Pittsburgh between the black kids and the white kids. Like, she was saying, you know, in the lunchroom, you feel like most of the black kids sit together, most of the white kids sit together. I don't know if this happens at your school, but it definitely does at ours.
Well, in my school, there's a bigger percentage of kids that are darker skinned than there are kids of lighter skinned or any other of any other race. So in our school, it's kind of mixed. Kids are always, like, it's like a trait at our school is that we are loud, that we express ourselves. The teachers don't shut us down for that unless we are too rowdy and we cannot hear the teacher. It's a pretty open school. Many kids sit where they wish practically in lunch. There is no separation. We're just all communicate. There's like nothing, no borders, no walls. It's just...
Yeah. I think that part of it also comes from who you spend time with. Like, if I'm talking to my friends, I'm usually talking about like my classes or homework or something relating to, like, if something funny happened in class, then I'm going to talk to them about it. And it's about like what Z was saying earlier. If she never sees these kids, she never has any time with them, then she's not necessarily going to spend time with them outside of class. And it leads to like a lot of, you know, missed opportunities for like friendships.
Yeah, it
and stuff.
Really does. It's kind of sad that I'm just now like experiencing and seeing these people now, like that it's the end of, like, towards the end of my junior year, and I never really knew them or got to talk to them or see them or anything else like that.
Yeah, so that's just one way that having this, not actual, of course, not, like, segregation, but this kind of separation between race and based on our level of classes can be really problematic.
How do you guys think this opposes in suburban schools, since we're all pretty much from the city? Like, how do you think it affects suburban schools or...
I feel
just
like
based on stereotypes.
At suburban schools, you know, we were talking about being the only black girls in our class. I feel like that's how every person of color would feel, like, the entire school day all the time. And I think that if you're surrounded by people who aren't inclined to agree with you or inclined to, like, listen to you, really, then you're going to feel pretty isolated and you might stop speaking up. I don't know if that's true for every student, but that's how I think I might feel. So we're going to wrap this up for now, but we'll be right back. This is Streaming Justice with Youth Express. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Streaming Justice, a youth-led discussion on civil rights, past, present, and future in honor of Dr. King. If you'd like to join in the conversation, we'd love to have your participation. You can call or text us at 412-200-5975 or tweet questions to PGH Youth Express. Right now we're being joined by a guest who has a question for us. If you could introduce yourself.
My name is Sheed Ansari, and I have a question or a scenario that I would like you guys to answer for me. Well, my scenario is if a black person or person of color is treated differently in a positive way, or say like colleges have to fill racial quotas, and is that necessarily racist or is it necessarily trying to make a step forward in progress?
I personally feel that there are other ways towards going about filling racial quotas or getting involved with students of color, and it shouldn't just particularly pertain to someone's race. Like, obviously there are scholarships for minorities and people of color, and I feel like that's fair because some people just don't have the opportunities, but then if you're better off and if you need the help, then you should get it.
Okay, well, just going off of affirmative action in general, I just want to clarify that affirmative action is more based off of income and less based on race in general. Like, obviously, there are some racial portions to it, but the majority of benefactors of affirmative action are white women, actually. I think that if a person of color is treated positively in general, like, that's good. But if they're specifically treated differently than other people, then you might want to ask why. I feel like I've been in that situation before, and in the past, part of it has been because of this guilt that white people feel. And that is not always productive, but it can be. I'm not sure exactly. In this specific situation, if it would be positive or not. I guess.
It depends on who may be treating you differently. I'm not sure. It all depends on who it is or why. Maybe it might not be totally something that is completely class-related.
I feel like you would be alienating the person in any situation, whether regarding race or class or color. Like, for example, I went to a camp when I was 12, and I was with another white girl who accompanied me on this trip, and part of the trip was we did volunteer work at this church, but this church was mainly African Americans, and she came up to me and she told me that she felt alienated and that nobody was really talking to her. And when we went back to the rest of the camp, I was like, wow, this is how I feel, because everybody else in the camp was pretty much white or not of color. So I feel like it really just depends on the scenario and who's in it, because any person would feel alienated.
I guess that's why I'm finding it a little bit hard to answer the first part of the question, which is about a specific situation. But the second part about affirmative action, I think that it shouldn't be necessarily grouped with being treated positively, because affirmative action, I feel, is more a response to a system of oppression, and that oppression would be poverty in this case. Because it's true that the cycle of poverty predominantly affects people of color, especially in this country. And I think that there should be some kind of response to that. It also goes back to reparations from things like slavery, where black people were exploited for profit for hundreds of years. And it's kind of like a response to that, because obviously you're not just going to recover from that instantaneously, especially if there is no system of reparations given to people of color. In the hundreds of years it has been, it's still not been enough to make up for it. So Zainab, did you want to talk about taking a look at other countries?
Sure. Well, I feel like America is different in the case about race, and that it's its own definite classification when you look at it. So, for example, my friend met this person from Uzbek. She's Caucasian, and she was trying to explain to him race in America, and she came up to me and she asked me if I could sort of write something down so he could tell, or she could tell him, and I was like, I really don't know. But race is such like a wide variety, and here it's definitely a problem, and it goes back for centuries, but it's also an issue in other countries. For example, a lot of people, when talking about slavery in school, like to bring up the fact that Africans sold other Africans into slavery to go to America. But slavery in Africa was not the same as it was in slavery in America. It was like a different kind. It was more like indentured servants, like getting people to clean your house. They still had rights back in Africa when they were, in quotation, slaves.
Right. Some people say that the Atlantic slave trade was the birth of chattel slavery, which was different than slavery of the past, because the first difference was that it was for an entire lifetime. In the past, slavery was not a permanent condition. And then the second thing was that if you were a slave, your children would be slaves, and their children would be slaves, and their children would be slaves, and so on. And then also it was based on race, which it never had been before. And the reason that it was based on race is because it made, well, there's two parts. It made white people feel better and justified. They were saying like, oh, well, it's okay because they're not fully human, so we can enslave them. And then also, it was a justification for the conquest that was also happening at the same time of Native American people and African countries, where it was justification for saying that they're not people, so we can take what's theirs, and that even goes so far as taking their lives. What I think is interesting is how in other countries, race is less of an issue, but also America ended slavery in, what, 1865, right? So it's been a while. We still haven't completely gotten over the effects of it, though, and my question is kind of why. Like, we haven't dealt with our history fully, obviously. Why is that, and why is it so hard for us to move on that we're still dealing with racism today in 2016?
I don't know. I personally don't think that there's going to be a sort of end to racism, or maybe I should say prejudice, but it's just something that's going to be there. There's always going to be people who have different opinions. For example, I know late last year there was an anonymous hack group that printed the names of senators or like popular people who have ties to the KKK.
If we could just hold that thought for right now, we'll be right back with Streaming Justice and Youth Express.
Hey guys, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Streaming Justice, a youth-led discussion on civil rights, past, present, and future, in honor of Dr. King.
So we were planning on talking about different approaches to change in this segment. I think that we should discuss systematic change specifically and the different systems that we see as systems of oppression. So Z, do you want to talk about systems that you know of?
So there's poverty, and when you think of poverty, my mind just goes to like a neighborhood or a place that you know that tends to hold more impoverished people. So it's definitely places like what used to be the East End, which is now a booming place, and that has a little bit to do with gentrification, if you'd like to touch on that, Ada.
Sure. I was just going to say that I heard this said recently by a youth organizer, and she was talking about how we define different neighborhoods and how we have all these phrases for majority Black and Hispanic low-income neighborhoods, like we say the ghetto or the barrio or whatever the case may be, but we don't always associate those same types of images with white people, and part of the reason for that is because there is a disparity in the amount of poverty between white people and people of color. So just going off of that, why do you think that people of color are impoverished more often than white people, and like, what are things that we can do to change that?
I feel that maybe it's because they don't get much of opportunity. They don't give opportunity to those to possibly do any better for themselves, mainly because, I don't know, maybe their color, mainly sometimes. It just, they feel like they did this to themselves. They should do it on their own at some points, I feel. But in other cases, it's probably not that. Many people have different prejudice towards those people because of certain things they heard about this certain area or these certain group of people. So it would be harder for them to get anything to help them, to help their family. Like, there's all kinds of terrible prejudice going around about how it's their fault or how they think certain things may be cooler to do. So then it puts them in a terrible situation by accident that they don't mean to.
Going off of what we were talking about earlier, off of education, if someone is suspended from school and expelled from school, then oftentimes they don't have a lot of options for them. They often have trouble getting jobs or even going to college and things like that. And it just limits the choices for people of color, and they may feel like they have to go into things like drugs when that's not really necessary. And it leads into cycles of poverty and cycles of oppression, because if someone is not able to send their kids to school, then those kids aren't going to get a high-paying job, and their kids are not going to be able to have the same opportunities, and it's just going to go on and on and on, kind of.
Definitely. Regardless of race, it's definitely a cycle, mm-hmm. and it's continuous. And personally, I think that it either starts at home or when you're young. And going back off of what Susan said, if you see a person, you kind of start to think, oh, what was their past? How did they get there? How did this happen to them? And then if they want to have kids, then it kind of just follows them, and it's not always their fault. So I guess the question what we should be asking or trying to solve is, how can we fix this system, and how can we better it so that it will stop happening to the same people and it won't continue generation after generation?
Yeah, I mean, that goes into things like prison reform also, because if someone has a criminal record or a history of even juvenile offenses, then it makes it much more difficult for them to get a job or go to school. And also, if they are in prison, then they are often exploited by private companies, since there is a major private prison industry in the United States. These companies that buy prisons make a lot of money off of their employers, I guess, the prisoners, because they can legally pay them as little as 25 cents an hour and just make so much money off of them. And that's part of why there's a mass incarceration, I think. That might be one of the parts of why there is so much mass incarceration of Black and brown people.
Well, doesn't America have the largest amount of mass incarceration?
Right. So the rate per capita of incarceration is much higher in the United States than in any other country, and that might be part of the problem, honestly, and disproportionately so for people of color as well. So as bad as that statistic is in general, it's much worse for Black people and people of color.
So going back to the problem, when people are faced with these kind of decisions, where do you think they go? Or when they're faced with poverty, where do you think it tends to lead them, and what choices do they make?
Well, it really can be difficult for people, because if you are impoverished and like you're just trying to go to public school and at school, you're getting in trouble for things like not being able to do your homework or, you know, not doing things outside of school. I can't think of a good example right now.
Doing something on the internet.
Yeah, let's just say that you work outside of school and so you didn't get your homework done because you have a job because you're trying to support your family or whatever. Then you come to school the next day and you're tired from working and you don't have your homework and the teacher yells at you and you get detention or suspended, then it just leads to more problems because you're either missing school or you're not getting what you need to know in preparation for that class, so you're behind, and it just leads to going on and on to kids not being able to finish school and getting into more and more trouble and feeling like that's not an option for them anymore, which is definitely a problem.
Some kids, they don't have certain things at home because of the certain amount of money that they do not have. So it's like it could be difficult to do something on the internet since everything's becoming so technology-wise. So it's just like they might not have a phone, they might not have a computer, they might not have access to any of these things because of the situation they're in. So then it makes it harder for them to do their homework, like you guys have mentioned. So then it would be then they keep getting like detentions and write-ups and stuff, and that makes it harder to do anything for their family because if they have to worry about stuff like that, then how are they going to worry about graduating? How are they going to worry about their family? How are they going to worry about their job?
Mm-hmm. It also definitely just puts them in a bad mental space.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a part of the problem. Like, for example, I know the Wilkinsburg School District is joining with the Pittsburgh Public School District.
Joining with Westinghouse.
Westinghouse, which is a part of Pittsburgh Public Schools. Mm-hmm. So why does Wilkinsburg have to join with Westinghouse? Why aren't we able to figure out a better way to help the kids stay in their own environment and not have to move on? Like, what is going on in the Wilkinsburg School District?
There's really bad stigma for the Wilkinsburg. I live in that district, so there's so much bad stigma. There's so many bad reports about them. There's so many bad things going on. So then it hurts the kids that want to do something. I have friends there who are doing, I'd hope, well, and then there are kids that are ruining it, like some terrible news reports that happened a few months back. So then it would be harder for anybody to get out of there.
Westinghouse is already, just based off the stereotypes that I know, Westinghouse is just not a good school, and this is going to sound really bad, but my mom used to threaten me that if I didn't do good at the school I was at now, that she was going to send me to Westinghouse. And I just want to know, why was that so threatening to me, and but what can we do inside of Wilkinsburg, and what can the community of Wilkinsburg do that can also help their students and help them gain the respect that they willfully deserve? Because these neighborhoods in Pittsburgh weren't always like the way they are now. It's just kind of sad growing up in Pittsburgh and then seeing places that you used to know and that were so beautiful and had artwork, and now they're like turning into mass malls and places like that are being taken over by people and big corporations that have so much money.
Just going back to what you said about Wilkinsburg, I think that it is awful when going to a public school is considered to be a threat. Especially because there are students who have to go there that don't have any other option, and they just can't get out of that system, and that's so awful to even think about for other students that they wouldn't even want to go there. Going to what you were saying about neighborhoods being taken over by corporations more, I think that you're definitely seeing that in East Liberty, and it's pretty much gentrification taking over in that area. I mean, one of my favorite murals in East Liberty is being painted over, which is very sad, but it just is an example of Black culture being covered up, and now it's turning into some office building or mall or something like that. But it's really a problem, not because obviously there's going to be consumerism in every neighborhood, but when people who have lived there for generations are being forced to move out of their homes because their rent's going up by so much, and there's a Target next door, so
Whole Foods and everything else.
And they can't afford to buy groceries at Whole Foods, so they're forced to move out of the city, and it's just turning more and more into segregation.
Or they move into, I think it's places like
McKee's Rocks.
Those are now becoming like the new East Liberty, or what used to be. Like, for example, on Penn Plaza, I know those residents this past summer were just like, all of them were just like evicted out of nowhere, and then the mayor had to come in and give them like 30 more days to move out, which is just wrong. And this past summer, I also talked to some local shop owners, and some of them didn't even want to talk to me about the problems they were facing and the things that they were going through because they've been here for so long and their family-owned businesses and run, and now they're just being kicked out and taken over by places such as like new coffee shops and other mm-hmm. things that don't give back to the community in any such way.
All right, so we'll be right back. This is Streaming Justice with Youth Express. We'll be right back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Streaming Justice, a youth-led discussion on civil rights, past, present, and future, in honor of Dr. King. If you'd like to join in on the conversation, we'd love to have your participation. You can call or text us at 412-200-5975 or tweet questions to PGH Youth Express.
I wanted to bring up a topic about how there are some groups around Pittsburgh that want to take down certain monuments just because of the people inside of the monument have had slaves in the past. For example, the statue on Mount Washington, there is Washington and Gaius Suda, and they want to take that down because Washington had slaves. But there are people that say they should and they should not.
So I think that most people would argue against that, or that would argue against that, would argue that it should remain there because of freedom of expression. And I think that's fair to say. I think that we can't really limit people's perspectives just because they don't agree with us. And if someone wants to make a piece of artwork or a monument that I don't necessarily like agree with, that doesn't mean it shouldn't exist, because as an artist, I make all kinds of pieces that people may not like or may disagree with, but that doesn't mean that they can't be there. And I think that as a counter to that, instead of taking down old monuments, we could work to establish new monuments of people that are working for civil rights or something like that, instead of taking down the statues of slave owners.
I feel that it's, in my opinion, it would be wrong, because you don't want to hide what your past was. Like, people aren't going to hide certain things of other kind of things that had happened in our history. Why would you want to get rid of something that had happened? Why would you want to hide that from your people? I understand that it could be wrong and it could feel not correct in this age, I guess, but if you were to remove things like that, you're taking a step backwards, and instead of acknowledging something that you've done wrong and trying to fix it, but hiding it and taking it away and trying to pretend it never happened, that won't help our people, that won't help our cause. It will go backwards many, many years mm-hmm. if we were to destroy something like that.
And I mean, technically, if you're going to take down the monument of Washington, you might as well take down the monuments of basically every other white leader
who's that's what they're planning on doing.
Yeah, it's just so ironic to me. I mean, you might as well just take them all down, because they, no matter what the textbook says or like what they did, their actions that lead up to them or insinuate that they were indeed racist or prejudiced. So going back to taking a step backwards in history, as Susan mentioned, there are many so Pittsburgh is notoriously known for people like Westinghouse and Frick and Mellon. And those are the sort of people who kind of built our city. But while they were building it, they were entrepreneurs, and they kind of lived in the not so great parts of town. But back then it was all that. And so what happened there? What do you think, Ada?
I think that more has to do with classism and just basically how they were able to exploit people working in the mills. It goes back to the labor movement, so around like the 19th century, or 20th century, yeah. where people were just being paid very little for their work in the steel mill and stuff. That goes back to industrialization and all of that. But it's kind of similar to what we were discussing earlier. It's basically just about how people in poverty were kept in poverty because people who were doing it just wanted to make more and more money, and they did. Like, these men that Zayden was mentioning were all millionaires before they died, and some of them, like Andrew Carnegie, contributed part of their money back into helping the city, which I think was good, because his contributions help a lot of kids in poor neighborhoods now get access to things like computers and books, which is nice. But I mean, that's not true for most of them. Going back to the statues and memorials, I think that the people that are arguing for this to be taken down, that kind of goes into a bigger issue. I know that it's happened across the country recently, but in a lot of universities and campuses, for example, at Georgetown and at Yale, students are demanding that halls that are named after slave owners be renamed and changed into the names of either Black graduates or people who have made a contribution to the civil rights movement. And part of that, I feel differently about it, and I'm not sure if you both feel the same way, but I feel differently because in a school like that, kids are paying tuition and they're paying a lot of money to go there. And their argument is just that having this name could just be changed and then they would feel just a little bit better about going to the school. And I don't know, how do you guys feel about that? And is it different or similar to the earlier situation?
I don't know how I feel about that because I don't really know whose place it is to decide which hall gets named after who. But if you took every hall and you named it after like an African-American alumni or everything, then they'd all just be African-American alums and then none of them would be Caucasian or of European descent, which is kind of just throwing it back in their faces. So I feel like if there's like a midpoint or like meet each other halfway type place.
I feel like if you were to take away names of certain halls, it'd be like taking names away of certain streets of certain, like it kind of feels like that in my opinion. Like if you were to take away a name of a hall in a school, if you, like you said, Ada, that if you were to take it away, you're paying a lot of money to go to these schools and you'd like to know where your school kind of came from, I guess, in a form. So it'd be like renaming a certain street because they didn't like the person who did it. I don't know. It could be seen different ways, and it just, it depends on, like, it wouldn't be totally okay. Going back to the one point about the statues, if you were to take away certain things, that'd be denying history.
Thank you. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you for supporting Streaming Justice. Up next is more music and conversation about civil rights, past, present, and future, in honor of Dr. Martin Luther King Day. Youth Express, catch the future.